Turn with me, if you will, this evening, again to the book of Ephesians, chapter 6. And we are coming near to the end of the book. I want to hand something out to you this evening that actually it's further definition of what we gave you last week. Now, what's nice about this, hopefully, it's in English. That would help. We had a few things in Greek last time, so this in English. And what this is just a description of the progression all the way from chapter 4, verse 1. And if you remember, as you walked with me through that, you can see the issue. And it would do you well to go back and just look at this, because what happens is Paul likes this. He has a thought and then broadens out into several thoughts, and then he picks one of those thoughts. You'll see, for example, the walk worthy is, we've talked to you about it, it's an aorist tense, which means it's the overriding one. All the other are present tenses, continually walking in an unworldly fashion, continually walking in love, continually walking in light, continually walking carefully. And then he says, let me talk to you about walking carefully more specifically. So he comes and gives us three negative positive statements. If you're going to walk carefully, you don't walk as unwise but wise. You don't walk as foolish but understanding God's will. You don't walk in drunkenness but you walk filled by the Spirit. Then he says, all right, now let me talk to you about this not drunk with wine but filled by the Spirit. And that becomes the next thought. And under this are five what we call participles, these ing words. He says, if you're filled by the Spirit, you will be speaking, singing. How do you like this? Thank you, Daniel. That's a good word. Melodying. This is good. Melodying, thanking, submitting. Those are all, by the way, those are all actions that will demonstrate the fullness by the Spirit. Understand not fullness with the Spirit, but fullness by the Spirit. And there's a very great difference between the two. So as the Spirit fills us, we speak, we sing, we make melody, we thank, and we submit. Then he says, now let me talk to you about this submitting. And so he brings us to the submitting, and under this, three areas, the marriage, the home, and work. And it's an erroneous division, but it will work, because you understand the slave part of it. We're household slaves, so really it is in the home. Maybe we should talk about, it doesn't matter anyhow, but you understand the issue. And under the marriage issue, wives, husbands, children, fathers, slaves, and masters. Now, we're not doing any more on this, because this actually summarizes where we have been. It helps you see the path if you want to go back and look at it, and takes us all the way from chapter 4, verse 1, all the way to chapter 6, verse 9. Which, by the way, when you think about this for a while, when you understand something. When you are, let's talk about submitting at work. Let's take all this down the far right-hand corner. We're going to start and move up. If you submit at work, okay, it evidences the fact, and you could do it without this, but evidences the fact that you are filled by the Spirit. And if you do it, it evidences the fact that you are walking carefully, not as unwise but wise, not as foolish but understanding God's will. And it also evidences the fact that you are walking worthy of the one who called you. See, all of this is under one umbrella, walk worthy of your calling. That's exciting. I hope it does as much for you as a summary of where we have been. And it brings, if you will, a conclusion to what we have been looking at for some time. Now, I was not sure, because ours is being repaired, that we would have an overhead, but I have some stuff for us tonight. But I did the outlines in such a way not to depend on this, just in case it didn't happen. So, we have two ways of doing it. We're going to summarize the thought of 6, 10, and following this evening. And then we're going to come back and do as we've been doing. We're going to specifically go line by line and word by word, if you will, through the section. But in the process of so doing, I want you to see just an overview this evening with me of what's going on in this passage, and that's what the outline is you have before you. There is no doubt as we come to this that we come to the 10th verse, which is basically the summary of this passage. What we end up having here is the word finally that you have there, the issue that he has, is how he concludes so many books with this finally statement. So now he's coming to his final thing, And you'll notice again, and we'll talk about this actually. This is exciting in a way, but we won't discuss it till next week. But it's interesting because just the reminder is this statement right here. You see what we call this. This is a passive, if you will, a divine passive. It is something only God can do. It is not strengthen yourself in the Lord, but be strengthened in the Lord. So you know the exciting part of all of this as you come down to this end. This, what we find from here on is what God alone can do. Nobody else. You can't do this. Only God can do it. Now, we're going to see in here, there's a part that we play, okay, in responding to that which God does. But it is an exciting thing. And the interesting thing is it's his strengthening here. It is in the power of his might. By the way, what is interesting, if you remember, go back with me. Let's just take a walk back for a while to chapter 1 just for a moment. We'll come back here in a moment. I just to see something, we will give just an overview. But go back with me to chapter 1 and verse 18 and where he comes in that prayer. I'm going to do the same kind of an outline that you have, this diagramming kind of thing. I will do that in chapter 1 and show you how that covers all the way from 119 all the way through, anyhow, through the end of chapter 2. We'll look at that another time. But look at this, if you will. I pray, verse 18, that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened so that you may know what is the hope of his calling and what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance saints. Remember again, hope of his calling, the past, and hope of his calling, not our calling, the glory of his, okay, riches. And then notice, if you will, then the surpassing greatness of his power. Now what's interesting in here is we have several words, okay? We have the surpassing greatness. That is an excessive word of his power. This is an according of the work, the working of the strength of his might. Now what you have in here, by the way, four different words in the Greek. You can't see them clearly in English, but you can see part of it, power. You can see working. You can see strength. You can see might. Those are four different Greek words, and why does he use four different Greek words? Not because he wants you to define what each word means, because he's trying to pile up words to show how mighty God is. Now, when he comes here, he will take two of those words again, you see, kratos, which is power, ischios, which is power. And again, he brings two of those four words into play here because from the beginning of this book to the end of the book, he wants to display and magnify the greatness of the power of God. Huh? Now you think about it again, because when you think about this, okay, remember going back, I pray that the eyes of your heart might be open so that you might see the surpassing greatness of his power. Think about this as we come to this section, because where does one find some of the greatest manifestation of the power of God? Does he not find it in the deliverance that God gives from the temptation and onslaughts of Satan himself? Does it? Is it not, okay? I mean, you can think about these other areas, but when it comes to the attack of Satan and you see the surpassing greatness of his power, so we are strengthened. And by the way, if you want to, there we'll go do one more word. This word right here, which is to be strengthened, is another word. It's the word, okay, we have in English. Don't try to take it straight across. It's a word we get dynamite from. You have the word is inherently power there, power here. So even here you have three different words that express the strength and the greatness of God. And it just would be, if anything, you go back to that prayer. I pray that the eyes of your heart, my heart, not these physical eyes, the eyes of the heart, might be open so that we might see how great is the power of God. And hopefully tonight, as we do an overview of this section, we're going to just try to do an overview, that somehow you and I will begin to understand some degree the greatness of the power of God in this realm. Now, that is the one thing, by the way. The other thing that is certainly that we would just make reference to, and then we will get into the overriding thought of the text itself, is this. Okay, look at this with me. Let me put this on here so that you can see this. See, notice, You're going to put on the armor of God, the panoply of God, so that you might be able, and this is our word that we want right here. This is where we are, right here, the word to stand. It is basically, it is in English, S-T-A, see? That's what it is, okay? And our English thing goes like this, see, which is nice. So you see the word stand in verse 11. Look at this now. Let me take you down just quickly here to verse 13. Okay, just wait. Now I'm going to have fun putting all this back together, but let's go. Here, verse 13, look at this. Look at verse 13. On account of this, you can receive again the armor of God that you might be able, and here's a word again. These are those three letters, see? These are the three letters. And by the way, the interesting thing is this thing here, where we have anti on the front. You know the word anti, okay? Because antichrist, right? Anti is against, okay? So that you may, so, but there's our word stand again. And then you see down here, look at this end here. Look at the word stand again. Okay, now watch. Now I go to the very next verse and look at how the very next verse begins, see? Very first word in the next verse. In fact, you could do it like this and look at this, see? See, stand here, same three letters again, see, and here's our word. If there's a whole issue of this passage, I go back to Watchman Nee's outline. You know, outlines are good if they define, see. Let me go back to his outline of the book of Ephesians, why I will ever remember it, and hopefully you will remember it. It is set, chapters 1 to 3. Why? Because we are seated in heavenly places in Christ, right? So that's the sitting part. Walk. We've just given you the outline. You have this outline before you. All of this under the walk worthy of chapter 4, verse 1. And you can see how all of this feeds down into the whole section, 4, 1 to 6, 9. So that's the walk section. What do you think this section is? Four times in these few verses is the word what? Stand. The whole outline of the book, a very descriptive outline of this book is sit, walk, and stand. Understand that you're seated in heavenly places in Christ with all, I like this, all of the attendant privileges there too. They say at graduation, I got to tell you what, the attendant privileges are unbelievable. Rights and privileges are unbelievable. The fact that I'm seated in heavenly places in Christ and the fact that I'm walking worthy and now that I'm going to stand. And so if there's any message of verses 10 to 20, it's just basically what? We need to stand. Now, with that in mind, let's see how much we can do this evening. And just to give ourselves an overview of this section, and let's see what we can do. All right. Walk with me, first of all, as we just start to do it with the outline you have. It is interesting because verse 10, as we saw, was the key. It's where it all begins for us. Where verse 10 was. Here it is. Verse 10 is the key. Finally, be strengthened in the Lord and in the power of his might. Now, in light of that, if you can look at what we've given you here, three things. In light of this, notice the opposition we face in verses 11 through 13, and it certainly is there. We can't miss the opposition that's there. The wiles of the devil, the schemes of the devil, and so forth. We'll talk about that. Then the weapons needed to face this opposition in verses 14 to 17, we're told to put on, put on, put on. And then the indispensable part that prayer plays in all of this in verses 18 to 20. So those are the three things, the opposition we face, the weapons we need, and the indispensable part that prayer plays in all of this. Now, you know what? Just those thoughts alone, without anything else, help us in understanding where life is in the power of God. We face an unbelievable enemy. We do not understand this enemy. We just don't. Just know we don't. I will discuss this further with you, but anyhow, we face an enemy that we don't even comprehend. We talk about Satan. We talk about how terrible it is to face Satan. We don't even begin to understand, my friend. It is part of our own problem. It isn't God's problem, the Bible's problem. It's our problem. But anyhow, we come to the sense of the devil we face, and then we understand the weapons we need. And by the way, all of the weapons we need are things that characterize God. I mean, the answer to Satan is God, is it not, right? Draw near to God, resist the devil, James. So we come to that, and certainly the prayer plays such an indispensable part. By the way, you know the book. The Old Testament book that is often thought of in relationship to Ephesians in the New Testament is what? Anybody know? The Old Testament book often thought of in somewhat of the Old Testament counterpart to the book of Ephesians is the book of Joshua. Now, when you think about that, almost as because of what's at the beginning of Joshua and what's at the end of Ephesians, is it not? Because what does he say to Joshua three times in chapter 1, right? He says three times to what? Verse 6, 7, and 9 is what? What? Be strong and of good courage, see? Be not afraid. And so if there's anything here as we talk about this, be strong in here, it reminds us of the words of Joshua and again the strength that God could provide. By the way, this quotation is interesting. Strength is a lot like beauty. Even the ugliest think they're not far off. Just think about it for a while, okay? Strength is a lot like beauty, and even the ugliest think they're not far off. Meaning what? The problem with us is that we really do think that we are pretty capable of doing. Fact of the matter is it not significant that prayer is put down in verses 18 to 20? Because it is that. And let me go back and just some observations. We may not get very far tonight, but we'll start. The observation is this, okay? We talk to people and we say, you know, you ought to pray. I think it is not, I don't know. I think there's another way, frankly. Okay, this guilt trip business. By the way, you know what? John Piper spoke to the alumni the other night, and it was a refreshing thought for some 15, 20 minutes is all he spoke. But interesting. I thought that just the summation of the thought is this. So much of the service we do to God is, quote, unquote, out of debt. We're trying to, you know, we're paying back this debt to God. And he says, you know what, you can never do it. And it's a foolish way, and it's a non-biblical way. And we've been fed this, he says, from the pulpit. You understand, he says, when you come to serve, you are not the giver. You are not the giver. Paul talks about, even when he was working so hard, about the grace of God that was working through him. God is always the giver. You are not the giver. He says, you must come to service not as the giver, but as the receiver. He says, that sounds so selfish, but it's true. You are ever the receiver. Because if you're trying to pay off the debt, all you do is keep getting in further debt because everything he does is of his grace, okay? So you can't do this, okay? And number two, it doesn't even work biblically. But the whole point of it is everything you do out of the grace of God. And what a beautiful thought that every time you come, I think of those of you who are going to serve as I serve. You understand, I come here tonight not as the giver to you. He alone is the giver. Huh? I come here as the receiver, if you will. And it's nice that maybe you would think of as the conduit of God's grace. Is it not beautiful to think of? I'm not giving to God. I can't give to God anything. It's an exciting thought. Always the recipient of his grace. Always actually the manifestation of that which he does through his grace. And so therefore we are not the givers. He alone is the giver. We are but the receivers and the conduits of that which he seeks to give to others. Now, coming back, the issue. As we come to this passage here, we understand that even in what we're doing, okay, but now let's come back to here and look for a while, because we need to realize what we face. I think it's significant here, and just want to pick up some thoughts here, because look at your English text or Greek text, everybody will do it in a moment. I'll show you the Greek text in a moment here. Notice the statement where he says that we're supposed to stand firm and so forth, but then he makes this observation. He says, for our struggle, verse 12, is not against flesh and blood. Now, notice this. Because it is not to us, okay? In other words, it is not to us the struggle. It is not talking about war. See, it isn't, I mean, although it seems like it talks about fiery darts later. This is a word used for the kind of thing that a wrestler would do. Someone who is on hand-to-hand combat with the enemy. Listen, I'm reading this, okay? Listen carefully. This, literally, there is not to us a wrestling with flesh and blood. You see, this is again an allusion to ancient Greek games, which had wrestling as an event. It just is very interesting because it's talking about the whole, you're not talking about the fight of the church. Huh? This is talking about me, you, right? It is the personal struggle that we have. And for all of us, we face these daily strugglings. And so as we look at this business, this whole section, it is talking about a struggling that we have. And we have it. You have it. I have it, right? I think, you know, another word that's used was stratum. And when it's used in James, James talks about the kind of things that there is the constant warfare that goes on. And we have a daily struggle. It is a hand-to-hand combat. We're not talking about some corporate thing. We're talking about a personal thing. We're not talking about what the church face. We're talking about what I face. We're talking about what you face. And you see, when you sit there in your context of your struggling, thinking, you know what, other don't have it like I do. Remember, there hath what? And I don't like this cross-referencing business, but I'll do it here because it does certainly support the point. There hath no temptation, trial, taken, but what? Such as is what? Common to man, see? This is not something, you know, I alone face this. Now, I face people on the other side who going through something say, well, I want everybody to admit you got the problem I have. No, don't play that game with me either. Just deal with your problem. But understand, as you struggle with this, even in 1 Peter, when he's talking about the devil in chapter 5, he says, because in verse 9, he says, these are the same things that your brethren are facing in the world. Don't ever think that you alone face these struggles, but understand we all face these struggles. And it's a hand-to-hand combat. Now, let me go back to what I was talking about. When we think about the issue of prayer, okay, let me go back to that again and put that in this context. Say to somebody, you ought to pray. No. That's, you know, what is this? I pray out of obligation to God. I pray out of duty. No. We have a prayer class at seminary. It used to be an elective. Now it's a required class. You know what the requirement is? One of the requirements? 1 hour of prayer per day. And men will say it revolutionizes their prayer life. They never prayed like this before. And when they, you can say, well, boy, it's a legalistic thing. But, you know, it's teaching them to stay in the presence of God. But you know, it's interesting that we get into this mode. Do you know why we end up and say, well, I don't pray as much as I ought to pray? You know why you don't? Because you don't understand how serious your predicament is. See, we wake up in the morning and we think, you know, I can do this. See, we don't say that to God. We don't say it to anybody. But by the fact we don't pray, we are saying that to God. See, I've got a good mind for business. I've got a good mind for Greek. I know how to teach God. I'll get on to you. When in fact, all of a sudden, the assignments are piling up and the responsibilities are getting great. And now, God, when I realize I need you, I'll come. God says, what you don't understand is you need me all the time because what? What's that verse? We all know it. Without what? Without me what? You can do what? Nothing. But we think we can. There's not one of us here in this room that doesn't think we can. And that is why we do not spend time in prayer as we should. And you see people say, I don't pray as much. You know why? Because you don't understand how serious your illness is. If this passage should do anything to us and why it leads to verse 18 into the prayer business, and this is what bothers me as we think discipling is saying to somebody, you know what, pray and give me a record. I prayed 5 times this week, therefore I must be spiritual. Listen to me. When you understand how serious your condition is and you're driven to prayer, you see, Martin Luther prayed hours a day, but he says when he found that the pressures became greater, he prayed more. When we find out the pressures are greater, we often pray less. If anything in this passage do it, we understand what we're fighting against. We're wrestling. We're wrestling, not against flesh and blood. And we get this business. You know, it's interesting because we so often think our problems are people. See, people here, people there, and this is our problem. That's not your problem, you understand, see? Problem isn't people. See, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. It's not Joe or John or Sally or Mabel. It isn't any of those. It's Satan at work. Notice, he says in here too, he not only is this, but he talks about the fact that we are doing it. And by the way, if I could, let me see if I can. Just so if I can bring it to your attention, see if I can find it here for us. Notice something. He starts in verse 12, and notice what he says. We do not, our fight is not, notice this word. Okay, watch this. Okay? Here's a word. By the way, let's talk about this word for a while. You know this word, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Here's our word. This is the word. Pros, see if I can do it in English. Toward God, see? Our battle is not face to face with flesh and blood. That's not where our battle is. And it's translated against, okay? But notice, so it's not, okay, not this. But it is, notice, this is the strong word for but. Strong is where there is. Strong word, but notice what it is. Notice this word against and against. Where is the other sheet I had? Anyhow, whatever it is, it's five times in here. The word keeps going against, against, against. Okay, forget it. We don't care, but, okay, here we go. We do care. See, one, two, look at this. See, look at this. Against again. Against again. See? So in other words, it is not against flesh and blood, but against this. And when you understand what we're fighting against, see, this is the issue. We'll talk about it, against rulers, against authorities, against, well, look at this, world power. See, this is the word, okay, by the way, this is our word worldly, this is the word power again, worldly powers, world powers, powers that dominate this world. The darkness of this world, spiritual forces of wickedness and so forth. And by the way, you see this in heavenly places. I tell you this because I remember years ago, I wrestled with this book of Ephesians. I've told you that many times. I keep telling you. But I wrestled with Ephesians. I could not preach on it for years because couldn't figure out chapters 1 to 3. Then when I finally figured out I could do it, I preached through chapters 1 to 3, chapters 4 and 5. I got down to chapter 6, and I finally got to this last section of the whole book, and all of a sudden, my eyes, the eyes of my understanding were open. I read this in heavenlies. And you know what? The word is all the way back in chapter 1, verse 3, but I didn't understand it. It's what I fought in this book, it's what I fought in Peter, and I want to tell you, it's what all of us fight. I'll say it again. Okay, see, I am a very earthly-minded man. I am. I'm not proud of that. But let me tell you, I am so earthly-minded. See, because I am so earthly-minded, I don't understand how earthly-minded I am. Now think about that for a while. On the other hand, you see, I am less earthly-minded today than I was a week ago. I'm less earthly-minded today than I was a month ago, 6 months ago, certainly a lot more than I was a year ago. But you see, I understand how earthbound I am. See, most of us, just listen to your prayers and understand how earthbound you are. Even it is a distressing thing for me still. I had more people this last week because people who haven't seen us for years, they say, how's your wife doing? I said, this question, why? Because they prayed during those years. But you know what? I get to tell you again, it's never been an issue of cancer. And we know it may come back again. We got 5 more months, and then this doctor setup will be over, and the medication that she's taking now will be ended, and so 5 years are over. But you know what? You know. You just flat out know, see? But I hear the clamoring, God, do this, and God, do that, and we're trying. You know, I don't understand why when I watch, sit in a session of theological men or arguing over whether the gifts are here today or not, and in the process they're saying we have more meaningful prayer meetings because we spent 2 hours praying for somebody's healing. So someone says, can you raise him from the dead? Well, I've never seen it, but I believe it can be done. I'm saying, why in the world would a Christian want to come back? What kind of earthly mindedness is there in that thinks somehow you want them back here again? Why do you want them back here again? God, for some reason, took my father when he was young and healthy, and I don't understand. But you know what? I have missed him. There's nobody. As long as I live, there's nobody who understood me and I could talk to, and he would know where I'm coming from, and driven the same way with the same passions, because it's after his life I would model mine. But you know what? There's no way in the world you want him back down here again. It is true. I thought what a great thing God brought Lazarus back to the dead. What do you mean a great thing? That had to be one of the most depressing moments. Why would you want to go to heaven and come back down here again? He didn't do it for Lazarus' sake. See, I thought he did it for Lazarus. He didn't do it for Lazarus, right? Huh? No, don't believe he did. He didn't do it for Lazarus. He did it. You know, it is the miracle. It is the culminating miracle that led toward his death. It is. You just look at any of the Gospels, and that's where the beginning of the end, see. This wasn't about Lazarus, and it wasn't even about Mary and Martha. You see, if God causes you to live down here a little longer, it's not, my friend, for your benefit. I don't know why. We cling on to life and say, God, please make me better. I say to you, I'm going to say it again. If I get seriously ill, okay, I beg of you, don't pray that I'll get better. Just pray that I'll have the grace to see it through to the end the way I should and not dishonor the name of God in the process. That's all. Because, frankly, I want to go home. Why stay down here? Who in the world? I mean, why would you want to stay down here? And I hear people at funerals, oh, you see, they died so young. What a waste. What a waste. What is the purpose of life? See, the whole point of all of this, we don't understand, is not about earth, it is about heaven, right? The blessings of life are not these things down here, the nice car, the nice house, the nice clothes. That's not the issue, my friend. The blessings are the heavenly blessings. For what? God has blessed us with all what? In chapter 1, verse 3, all spiritual blessings where? In heavenly places in Christ. I wrestled so long with 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 1 to 10, because I could not see the heavenliness of the passage. It just passed me by. I was approached 15 or more than that, 20 years ago, to write a commentary on 1 Peter, twice by the same publisher. I didn't go to him, he came to me. I turned him down because I couldn't figure that passage out, and it was because it's so heavenly minded, I couldn't comprehend it. Someone says, what changed? I said, I did. Did you understand that what we're talking about, you see, the battle is in heavenly places, not down here? Listen to our prayer requests. Listen to what we pray for. So earthbound I am, you are. The whole problem is that many of us don't realize how earthbound we are. And we keep yoking ourselves up with this world. Okay, so now, with this in mind, understand the battle, okay? We understand this. Understand what we're facing. Now notice, it's a personal struggle. Notice something else in here, though. The next thing you have on here, it says, we face evil days. We face daily conflict. Secondly, we face evil days. Now, there is a question here because, let me see. What? Just one moment. Give me a moment here. Notice this. Against the world forces. Tell me what verses is in. Okay, verse 13. Here we go. Let me see if I can find verse 13. And we put it back up here again. See if I can find this. I want you to see something. 12, 10, 13. If one day we get a PowerPoint machine of our own, we'll solve this problem very quickly. But this is all right. We don't mind. This is the poor man's version of this. Watch this. Watch this. Watch this. With me, please. Notice this. Put on the armor of God that you may be able to stand. And notice this is very interesting, by the way. Those of you who've had Greek from me understand something. Look at this, see? This is the word evil here, see? This is the word day here. Now, just like in English, the normal thing is to take this word evil and put it right here and say, just like in English, the evil day. But now watch something. When they put it this way, let me give you an example. When Jesus said, I am the good shepherd, he said this. I am the shepherd, okay? And he puts the article in front of here. The good one. He says, I am the true vine. He says, I am the vine, the You can't read it, but it doesn't matter. True. Now let me tell you what's important about that. See, you can say, well, what difference does it make? No, it's so important. This is how Jesus said. He didn't say, I am the good shepherd. He said, I'm the shepherd, the good one. When you put the noun first, that's what this is, a noun. You know that much, don't you? Okay. Vine, you know. Students don't know, but I'm sure all the rest of you do. Because when we went to school, they taught us grammar, right? And they taught us the 12 times table, too. Anyhow, enough of that. All right, here we go. Notice what happens. When you put the noun first and the adjective second, and both have their own articles like this, it is equally distributing the thought. The emphasis is not, I am the good shepherd. The emphasis is equally distributed. Jesus is saying to them, I am the shepherd. Now let's stop there for a while. If you're going to preach on this, you start and talk about, I am the shepherd. I am the shepherd. I am not the hireling. I am the shepherd. And I happen also to be the good one. He says, I am the vine. See, and they knew this. They knew this. It wasn't, I am the true vine. I am the vine. You see, they had on their coins, they had a vine, see. And it was the sign that, it was a sense of the picture of, I am an Israelite because I am a part of this vine, which is Israel. Jesus says to them, I am the vine. Not only that, I am the true, authentic one, see. When he comes here, he says, you know what? In the day, the evil one. Now, let me tell you what I think this is doing here. There's a question, but this is the right conclusion. I'll tell you that. He's not talking about there's just, we have trials on some days. No. You know what? We not only face a daily struggle with Satan, but we face evil days. We face evil days. Your evil day is different than my evil day, but it will be an evil day, or there will be evil days, but they will be specific days, not just generally evil days. We face specific evil days. Think about that for a while. In this sense, when you ask, okay, what was that evil day for Moses? It was a day of what? Huh? Well, what happened? When he says, I did not count God as holy, and because of that, God did not let him go into Canaan. What was that happened on that day? He was tempted and succumbed to what? Anger. Did he not, right? He struck a rock. That was his evil day. Talk to me. What was the evil day of David? Huh? Day of what? Not a day of anger, but a day of what? Lust. Try me out. What was the evil day for Hezekiah, the king? Anybody know? It was a day of pride. They came to visit. It was even a nation that wasn't in power, and he took and displayed everything to them, and they were to remember. And God says, because of what you've done, they will come back. See? Hezekiah, what a weird duck this guy is. He's a good man. Look at all the godly things he did. But look what he says. God, I'm just glad. It won't happen in my day, okay? Just thank you for that. What is this? A day of pride for Hezekiah. As great as the man may be, it was a day of pride. How about Peter? A day of what? What would you think, Peter's? What happened? 3 times he denied Christ. Why? Because he was what? He was fear. I don't know what your evil day, but there is a day. There is the onward struggle against Satan and his forces and powers, and we'll talk about that next week. But there is, beyond that, there is that sense that there are those days. Whether it's a day when the army is out to war and you should be fighting with them, and you're standing on top of the building and you look down and see Bathsheba bathing. Or whether it's that day you become so aggravated with the people. And you know what? I think of that so often. You see, this is where I got to tell you. You understand the holiness of God, you better. I don't. I'm trying to see. It's the truth. Moses says, I don't want the job. God says, it's yours. Moses says, I can't, it's like carrying a bunch of children across the wilderness, and I want out. And God says, listen, boy, that's not the option for you. These people are aggravating people. God put you in power. They keep fighting, fighting, fighting. Even your own sister does, see. And God gives her leprosy for a while, see. Finally, you get discouraged, and you just get uptight. And one day, out of anger, you hit a rock, and God says, because you hit the rock, you will not go in the land. You know, I did just, and this is not, by the way, I say this because I was talking to someone the other day and made a statement with regard to Christ and something he did, and as I'm talking to God, I say, you understand, I'm not speaking lightly of you because I just am very careful about that. But now let me in a moment, and I'm in great reverence saying this. If I were God, see, but I'm not God, and that's the whole point of this, see, and that's why I don't understand his holiness. I you know, after all that he'd gone through for 40 years with these painful, miserable people, I at least let him walk over the Jordan. That's what you start out to do. Then take him. No, can't even cross the Jordan. Just look over and I'm going to take you, see. Yep. You can say, well, God can't help it. I mean, what in the world? What do you expect from your human that I am, see? Just understand something. There is a day. There are those days. Because, just a thought. You see, I put down here deceptive tactics. And I want to think of this just for a while, just for a bit. Just so you probably have a thought for this week. We'll come back to this. Satan is so deceptive, isn't he? Now just wait. See, Joshua can beat anybody who fights against him, see? He can. It's when the Gibeonites come up dressed like that that he just for a moment he loses it. And he doesn't think through the process and he makes a pact he never should have made. Satan, let me tell you what, you can fight straight on. If he came at you and he's directly facing you, you can do it. See, you know you can do it because you're prepared, but that's not how he comes. See, we'll talk about that. Doesn't come that way. It is so deceptive, and you rationalize away, and you know what, and this kind of stuff, and you know, well, whatever. Whatever the excuses people give for what they do. And the opposition is so great. He opposes everything. He opposes prayer. Just think, maybe you read for next week, but you come back. Daniel chapter 10. When the angel of God shows up to Daniel, he says, you know what, you prayed 21 days ago, and it took me this long to get through. Now, let me tell you something. This is an angel of God, and it takes him 21 days to get through the powerful forces of Satan to get to the side of Daniel. Amazing. Paul writes the church at Thessalonica. He says, I tried to come more than one time, and Satan hindered me. I wonder myself, as you think about this, for many of us, we don't see. We're in another world. See, we have the problem because the tire's flat or whatever, and the car cracked up or whatever. As if those things even matter in eternity. But we get into those kinds of things. Those become the world. We don't even understand what Satan is doing. We don't even recognize as Satan doing it. I think to myself, too, we don't understand what Satan's doing, understand what God's doing, because if Paul could write in 1 Corinthians, he says, because of the sin in the church, and the church is not that big a church, it's all right, it's growing, but it's not that big a church. He says, because of the sin there, many, not just a few, but many are sick among you and many sleep. Huh? People were dying and ill because they were disobeying God. If that was true then, you don't think it's true now. You know, the problem is we don't recognize that some of what God does is an act of God's judgment, if you will, punishment, if you will, discipline of us because of how we live or don't live. We don't see the hand of God. We don't see the hand of Satan. And we ought to. We ought to. We ought to. But my friend, so long as you are delayed from seeing the hand of Satan and the fact that he and his forces are struggling daily, and there are evil days when they will find a way to come in and they'll get you. If you don't watch it, they'll get you. And you see, that is what should drive me to prayer. I don't want that day to get me. I know the day will come, but I don't want it to get me. Right? It will come. Don't know what it'll be. Day of fear. Day of anger. Day of pride. Day of lust. That you may be able to stand in that evil day. Now really, if you believe that, does someone have to prove to you that you ought to pray? Or are you going to be driven to pray because you, like Scott Florin, will realize, you know what? Without prayer, this is total disaster and there is no hope. And that's true. That is true.